So you are here. You're speaking tomorrow evening at the University of Auckland, launching the Faculty of Arts New Public Policy Institute tonight as well. So tomorrow evening, you will be speaking on what you see as the overlapping economic challenges, geopolitical changes and tensions, making the global economic scene riskier and more unpredictable than at any time since the late 1960s. I thought we could just start off today, but just tell me a little bit about your background. You have quite an extensive background.
Well, I'm basically an economist who tried his hand at politics.
Right.
Failed at politics in terms of losing the election in 93. I've worked for our Treasury, the Reserve Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the UN, ADB, or most of the major agencies as an economist. As an academic, I've been a professor at University of New South Wales, head of a business school at Macquarie, now at ANU in the Crawford School. In business, I did a lot of advisory work in the 80s. I was one of the founders of Macquarie Bank. When I left politics, I chaired ABN AMRO Australia, or on the board for 11 years. A whole host of company appointments. These days, I do a lot in climate change and renewable energy. Mm-hmm. I run a couple of charities on a whole range of not-for-profit boards. Four or five media events a week, so keeps me out of trouble.
Still very active, and you're writing for The Guardian as well, which is
I write regularly for the Sydney Morning Herald, well, for Fairfax, but I also do selected ones for most of the other papers. So.
Fantastic.
A couple of columns a week, basically.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, very broad set of skills.
Well, you know, my passion is public policy.
Right.
In whatever guise I've had, whether in business or government or academia, my focus has been public policy.
All right. So, and talking about why you're here in Auckland, so you're believing geopolitical changes and tensions making economic scene riskier than any time since the late 1960s. What sort of geopolitical changes are you talking about?
Well, it's a combination of economic challenges, which are just unprecedented, with an overlaying layer, if you like, of geopolitical tension, which is perhaps more difficult to handle than it's been. Now, a lot of the economic challenges have to do with the way policy authorities responded to the GFC, for example, where they flooded the world with liquidity, having created the GFC by flooding the world with liquidity. Mm-hmm. They don't have any answers as to how to disengage from that. With all that money pumped into the system, we haven't seen the pickup in economies that you would have expected. Business investment's been reasonably flat. Although some growth numbers have got better in the last year or so, people have doubts that they're sustainable. Mm. That's all been complicated, of course, by the arrival of a range of new leaders, mostly outside major political parties. So the world's gone for the outsider, for the messiah, somebody who's going to make a difference, shake things up. So I might have said that the world is more unpredictable and risky pre-Trump. It's even more so now with Trump.
Yeah.
You know, if you think you can run the free world on 140 characters in a Twitter feed, I'm staggered, really. But and his promises in economic terms will compound their economic difficulties. So there's a lot of dimensions to the uncertainty.
Absolutely. I mean, it's clear there's been a strong and mounting anti-government movement sweeping the globe.
Yeah, it's manifested itself in different ways, but essentially it really is anti-establishment, anti-government, anti-traditional parties. And then there's versions of that, whether you're looking in Washington or Brexit or Macron or in France or Germany. It's come in different ways on different issues, but it's really pretty significant in terms of its overarching impact. And that's created a lot of uncertainty because, again, people don't know where that's going to go. You know, in Europe, you've got mass migration as an issue. Some countries just closing their borders. Others are taking a lot. The pressure within Europe for fragmentation after Brexit's pretty real. At a time where the central bank is still trying to stimulate the economy and avoid another recession with deflation, you know. So it's a set of challenges they never imagined they'd have.
Yeah, and you say that they're trying to undermine and reverse much of what globalisation has caused.
Yeah, well, part of it is an anti-globalisation sentiment, and it's easy to feed that. And you've seen, you know, Trump starts off by focusing on the grumpy old disadvantaged low to middle income white male who hadn't seen an increase in their standard of living for a couple of decades, heavily concentrated in four Rust Belt states. So, okay, you can get them to listen because you're promising to do something about it. And then he sort of links that to, well, you know, it's obviously been cheap Chinese imports, cheap Mexican imports, or so you get an anti-trade sentiment, or these people are coming across the border and taking out, taking your jobs, so that's an anti-immigration sentiment.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and then, of course, that's all compounded by the fact it's an anti-Washington sentiment. You know, he's going to drain the swamp. And so he got a core level of support sufficient to get him across the line, even though he didn't win the popular vote. But with a whole lot of promises he can't deliver. I mean, a lot of the lost jobs in Rust Belt states had nothing to do with of imports. It had everything to do with technology, robotics, you know, artificial intelligence, these sort of trends which are very real. And so he's made all sorts of promises about how he's going to block Mexican imports by putting a tax on them.
Yeah.
And I'll use that money, he says, to pay for the wall. Well, you know, he's never heard of tunnels or planes or ships. And secondly, you know, the impact of that tax is on Americans. I mean, they'll pay the increased cost of the goods, not the Mexicans.
Yeah.
I'm just laughing. So he's got all these sort of policy prescriptions floating out there. Most of them are undeliverable. And, of course, his big ones are huge corporate tax or personal tax cuts and big infrastructure projects. But you know, the US budget deficit's about 3% of GDP still, and the debt's over 100% of GDP. So, you know, he hasn't got much capacity to actually stimulate the economy. So,
I mean,
and
I think
he's
with
got
Trump
a
is about,
Congress.
Yeah, but Trump is about also his own sort of whistleblowing and all of his own rhetoric that he tries to build for himself. I mean, he,
well, there's, you know, there's his
words.
Facts and then everyone else's is fake news,
yeah.
You know. So yeah, it's hard to win that argument when you put down a bit of evidence. But, yeah, look, and he's finding life very difficult. I mean, the domestic situation in the US political system is there are very real checks and balances on the capacity of the president to do very much at all. I mean, here's the Republicans with control of both houses of parliament. They've had a cause to live for 8 or 9 years to abolish Obamacare, and they had 3 attempts and can't get it through. And, you know, what will happen to his tax cut proposals? They're pretty vague as they stand, but they'll be, if they get through at all, they'll be really watered down and changed and refocused. And same with infrastructure programs. So domestically, he hasn't got a lot of room to move, although as commander-in-chief in external issues, he's got a lot of freedom, as we saw with the attack on a Syrian airfield. You know,
he
can make a decision and he can implement that decision. Bush Jr. went to war without congressional approval. You know?
Yeah.
They have a lot of power offshore, and that's, I think, that's a geopolitical tension that really worries people.
Right, but I mean,
what is he going to do with North Korea? You know.
Yeah, but I mean, politically, if you can't pass legislation, which he's not, then it's useless.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's really finding out how tough government is. I mean, I really do think he had a very simplistic notion of government. I mean, he'd been a successful reality TV host, and you know, he was able to fire people at will. He has found that a little more difficult getting into government and trying to run the place the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and you can't deal with complex issues, and most of the issues today have been left adrift, so they are now quite large and complex. And you can't deal with those in 140 characters, or even if you double up on your Twitter feed, you still don't get to say very much. So, I mean, he's showing how inexperienced he is. But he's not the first to do that. I remember when Jimmy Carter came in with his boys from Georgia, you know, they're going to restructure Washington. Didn't take too long because they seemed to be pretty ineffective.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's really a creature of Washington, like Lyndon Johnson, for example, who can actually get something done.
Right.
Whether or not you agree with what they do. I mean, he could work the Congress, and not too many people have been able to do that. Reagan did by just sitting on his position and not moving. But you know, not too many others have had much success in terms of managing Congress, so they don't really understand the way it works.
And bringing it back to New Zealand, have you been following much of our election?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you think we fit into that scape of that sort of anti-establishment?
Well, you know, in the 80s, I came over here and did some speaking at the National Party and a couple of other conferences and so on. And, you know, I remember when Muldoon left government, the economy was really bankrupt, you know, and credit rating was being downgraded, huge debts. And Longy came in with no real policy strategy to fix it, but put in place a team of people and was able to make dramatic change quite quickly, and he got re-elected. And you know, when I looked at that, I mean, you don't have states, you don't have an upper house. The party that won at that time could govern. Whether you agreed with him or not, that was
it. Was first
then, of course,
the post,
you introduced MMP, which is now meant that you'll only ever have, so I guess mostly only ever have coalition governments. And so Dens come in, you know, didn't win the majority of the vote, but managed to stitch up a deal with registered in Peters.
Yeah.
You know, at a significant price.
Yeah.
I mean, I sometimes wonder what it might be like in those cabinet meetings going forward. It's not going to be an easy road to hoe, but I gather she's made a few changes already, consistent with what she said.
I mean, what sort of economic challenges do you think that this New Zealand government faces?
Well, you know, you're coming off whatever you think of Key's administration, a pretty stable government that delivered pretty good outcomes across the board. I mean, you can debate the detail of some of them, but I mean, the issue is now whether you can sustain that while achieving some of the other objectives that Ardern has promised to.
And, yeah, much more socially,
you know,
focused.
Again, you come back against limited monetary and fiscal policy constraints. Yeah. And, you know, so the jury's out to see what can be done and whether she can work the parliament, you know, whether she can hold that coalition together. The Greens are going to be biting at her heels all the time. You know, it's not going to be easy. And, of course, the Nationals had the largest vote and just a few seats short of getting there.
Mm.
I mean, they can be pretty effective opposition. So let's see how that unfolds.
We've seen that even in the past few days, National using their power to halt to get more select committee seats.
Yeah.
So they halted the election for the Speaker of the House.
Yeah, I mean, they'll play pretty hardball, I think. I think they were amazed that Winston didn't go with them. But I mean, from the outside, I didn't think he got on with Bill. So I didn't think it was going to happen.
He's an unpredictable dude.
So maybe there's a whole lot of other issues in there.
Yeah. So Winston is actually at APEC at the moment. The conference is underway. And the TPPA is definitely going to be a point of discussion. Now, the National Party had the upper hand in doing a lot of the negotiations. But it's going to be Jacinda who will be signing it. What are your thoughts on the TPP?
Well, now the US is not supporting it.
Yeah.
I think that... although I must say that some of Trump's recent comments have been much more, you know, subdued.
Mm.
And he's sort of saying, going back to the position that, well, I'm not against trade deals, I'm just against the ones that don't suit us.
Mm.
Although most of the ones that America's done do suit them. But, you know, having said that, I think the rest of the constituency really do want some sort of agreement. I think it's an opportunity to build that. How much you have to compromise in that process and whether you create the circumstances where the US actually does come back in.
Mm. Do you think that that's likely?
Well, I think Trump's realised that, you know, to do some of the anti-protectionist things that he promised, he'd initiate one hell of a trade war.
Mm.
Although his rhetoric in Japan was, you know, you've had a surplus with us for a long time, it's not acceptable, you know, I'm going to fix it. I don't know what they think he's going to do, and there's not much you can do. They've made a few protectionist initiatives in the US, and they're threatening to do it all the time, but they haven't really done the big ones yet. So we haven't got the, you know, it's all right to do one. You can act unilaterally on trade if you want to, but don't imagine you won't get multilateral consequences.
Right. Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
where we sit. And I think Trump's come to the view that maybe he could be part of it in certain circumstances. But, you know, he's also got the NAFTA negotiations where he threatened to pull out, and now he's sort of, they're trying to save it. So I guess, you know, I'm in favour of freer trade. I mean, it's a framework within which you do that, but it's never been free trade. And, you know, it's a complex issue because not just the tariff walls, it's all about, you know, quarantine restrictions and anti-dumping rules and other ways in which you achieve a similar outcome. So you've got to put all those alternatives on the table when you put a package together.
Absolutely. I mean, how do you think that an agreement like this could have, what impact do you think it could have for a small country like New Zealand?
Well, both Australia and New Zealand depend pretty heavily on trade, you know.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
And we need to be able to get access to markets as we've, you know, where we've got competitive advantages, of course, we want to be able to exploit them. You don't want them blocked by you know, some unjustified tariff war. And basically, we've seen that freer trade is a positive. You know, it's not a zero sum game. It's a positive for the world. And you know, so to sort of try and say we better reverse globalization, you know, having seen the benefits of globalization over several decades, it's pretty short-sighted. Not to say that there haven't been elements of globalization, which, you know, some of the inequality that's come within countries has been a big issue, is a big issue, say, in the United States. But across countries, I mean, you've been able to dramatically reduce global poverty as part of that process. So the distribution perhaps not as good as it should have been, but it's better than going back to a world where you just close in and become very nationalistic. And for Australia and New Zealand to have to face that sort of reality, restricted flows of people and goods in particular, maybe capital in some cases. We're seeing some limitations now on capital flows out of China, for example. You just got to worry about, that's all counterproductive for us, because we really have an interest in an open trading, globalised world that has pretty free flow of people and goods and capital. If we don't get it, we pay a price.
Right, right.
That's not to say that we shouldn't domestically be trying to find ways in which we can actually grow the size of our domestic market, but so much of what we do is what we use, whether it's in business or in our personal lives, is basically imported.
Right,
because we can't produce a lot of those things at scale.
You said that many of the key economic relationships that economists tend to take for granted seem to have broken down now. What are some of these sort of economic relationships?
Well, there's a lot of obvious ones. I mean, the monetarist view that if you flood the world with liquidity, you'll create hyperinflation. Inflation will soon run away. And we've had just the whole period since the GFC where we've bumped along the bottom with really significant pockets of deflation in Europe, in Japan, elements in China at times, in the United States. I mean, people are staggered that the inflation rate in most cases hasn't got to the bottom of the target range.
Right.
And yet, even though growth has picked up and some of the employment growth has been extremely strong, as in the United States, you haven't had a pickup in wages, you haven't had a pickup in inflation. Those sort of relationships have broken down. I mean, economists used to believe you had a bit of a trade-off between unemployment and inflation. You could tweak them, that trade-off doesn't exist. Obviously, you've had a lot of growth without any inflation, and you've had a lot of employment growth without any inflation. So there's, and central banks are sitting there today with massive balance sheets. They've bought a whole lot of bonds and other paper to put money into the system. Which they never imagined they'd do, and they can't disengage from that. I mean, this talk of let's normalise interest rates, whatever that normalise means in this world, but put interest rates back up in a world where you've got a currency market, a bond market, a stock market globally that's dependent on the fact that they've come down, and they don't see how the impact's going to work if you start putting them up. You could choke economic growth and create a crisis in each of those three financial markets. So you've got to be very careful. And of course, the Fed's always, wanted to put interest rates back up to normalise. They've only done a couple of steps in the last couple of years. So it's not just about what's happening in the US that they have to worry about, but there's about $20 trillion worth of US dollar-denominated debt in the emerging world. Yeah. So you start putting up interest rates in countries which are already in recession, you're going to cause an enormous global shakeout. So, I mean, they've got to be very careful. I remember back when Bernanke was head of the Fed, he said he was going to end quantitative easing, that's the injection of cash into the system, and start just taper it. Within 10 days, the stock markets of every emerging nation, stock markets and currencies of every emerging nation, fell between 10 and 20%. It tells you that sensitivity is very real.
Yeah.
You get it wrong and you could precipitate a significant global crisis.
Mm.
So, you put up interest rates by 25 basis points, probably not going to make too much difference, but there'll be a 25 basis point increase that actually shakes the place.
Mm.
And that's the danger they've got. Now, of course, Trump's getting rid of Yellen and putting in a new head of the Fed who's got a reputation, but let's see how he does in the job. It's a lot more uncertainty, right, about how monetary policy can unfold. They don't have any capacity. If there was to be another global financial crisis, they really haven't got the capacity to inject liquidity into the system again. And they can't go to the budget because it's still way out of line, and budget deficits and debt are still very significant constraints. So you don't really have the policy capacity anymore that you had before to deal with those sort of issues. The uncharted waters. You'd have to say there's no history on which to draw. You haven't got any experience in the past. You can look back and say, oh, that's what we did then.
Mm.
Well, that's what we shouldn't have done then. You don't have any relevant periods to compare it to. So it's really a very challenging time for policy authorities and governments. And I guess the big complicating factor over all that has been the government has basically become, or politics has become, very short-term in its focus, very opportunistic, pretty populist, often quite negative in Australia, particularly true.
Yep.
And that means that you don't have any genuine debate about public policy. You don't have any evidence-based debate. I mean, you stick your hand up in Australia and say, oh, I want to do this, and the other side immediately says no. And so we move on to another day and another issue. Mm. And the problems just get left adrift.
I mean, you were a promoter of neoliberalism in the 90s. Mm. Do you still stand by its efficacy now? Do you think that it is to blame for much of the political unrest?
I'm very critical of the way a lot of it was done. I mean, right. Quite often, you know, take the power sector, right? They privatised power assets, sold generators and distributors and some retailers. But they just did that to make money for the government, to maximise the revenue, rather than worrying about the competitive structure into which they were selling it. The same as Telstra, you know, they privatised Telstra as a major telephone company. Now, one option existed, as we talked about at the time, is just keep the network in public hands and let all the service providers compete, Telstra just being one of them, on the same basis. There are ways in which it could have been done better, and of course, there's not been much thought about the impact on inequality in some of those changes. And, you know, when Australia is a small market, you know, as in New Zealand, you take a major government asset, pretty much a monopoly, mm-hmm. put into the private sector, you know, and then they go on a profit motive rather than, you know, customer service sort of orientation or shareholder motivation or something. You get completely different outcomes. And now none of that was actually thought about when those assets were sold or privatised. And so I think competition policy in Australia has basically failed because we haven't really concentrated on what sort of competitive structures you want. We'd be the only country in the world that's got two supermarkets that account for over 80% of the supermarket market. And then you let them have grog and petrol and insurance, and, you know, like it's just, it's become incredibly concentrated. And that's not just important in terms of the impact on price, but it changes people's lifestyle. You go to a major supermarket and the brand you thought you were going to buy is not there anymore. Right. They're pushing their own brand down your throat and this sort of thing. It's very constraining. So nobody's ever looked at any of that and thought about any of that in terms of the political debate. We've just done it, moved on. And the consequences are now being recognised.
All right. Well, thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
So we can you're speaking tomorrow. The talk is called "The Most Risky and Unpredictable Global Outlook in My Lifetime."
Yeah.
Friday the 10th. That's tomorrow, 12 to 1 p.m. at the OGGB Lecture Theatre, Auckland University Business School. Anything else you'd like to add?
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, awesome.
Good time to be here with a new government and
yeah, finding
their feet. See how it's going to work out.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. Thanks, John.
Thanks, mate.